Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, September 24th, 2024, we're delighted to host a short introduction to electronic discovery. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I'll keep my introduction of our guest today brief. But if you'd like to know more, you can access his impressive full bio at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Professor Theodore Hirt, who currently serves as a professorial lecturer in law at the George Washington University Law School. Before coming to GW, Professor Hirt was an attorney with the Department of Justice's Civil Division from August 1979 to March 2016. He was in the Federal Programs Branch from 1979 to 2008 as a trial attorney, senior trial counsel, and assistant director, and then in its Office of Immigration Litigation from 2008 to 2016 as a trial attorney and senior litigation counsel. Among his responsibilities during that time was being an advisor to the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Division. Mr. Hirt's areas of specialization include First Amendment issues, internet and telecommunications law, electronic discovery, and today's program. And I will leave it there. A last note throughout the program, if you have questions, please submit those via the question and answer feature so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's program. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Professor Hirt, the floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you very much, Kayla, for that nice introduction. Welcome, everyone, to our program today. It's very difficult, I will say, to do an introduction to the complex world of electronic discovery. But as they say in the time allotted to me, I will do that. And as Kayla has indicated, we will welcome questions at the end. As you can expect, any views today, I expect, will be my own. And not of anyone else, obviously, on the program. So my PowerPoint is not advancing here. Let's just see what's going on. Okay. Let me issue the first disclaimer, which is anything I say today is my own opinions, not those of the Federal Society. One thing I want to say about electronic discovery before we start is that electronic discovery comes in all flavors. Basically, my background has been in federal civil litigation, but electronic discovery is also featured in criminal prosecutions, both state and federal, in regulatory and investigatory settings, and in internal settings, including corporate investigations. Also, litigation under the Freedom of Information Act. So one thing I also want to indicate is that many of the people in my audience today may or may not be litigators, but electronic discovery is also important to the corporate world, the transactional world, because whatever you are doing, your company or client will be storing items in electronic format. In the field of electronic discovery, it also is a wide range of civil litigation, ranging from complex litigation to very simple litigation, to use that term. We even see electronic discovery in domestic relations litigation. But we see it more typically in corporate litigation, personnel and employment litigation, and public sector litigation. One thing I also want to emphasize is that in a one-hour program, we really can't do justice to a lot of the complexities, including the terminology. I'm going to list at the end of my program a lot of useful sources for you to consult. Some of the foremost sources I'm going to cite come from a group based in Arizona called the Sedona Conference. The Sedona Conference is a think tank, basically a nonpartisan think tank, and it studies a wide range of complex law, including electronic discovery. And they have a working group, one of which I am a member. So we want to think about any of their situations where they have commentaries. Another thing I want to start out with is that we want to have some sort of working definition of electronic discovery before we start. And it's basically the process of identifying, locating, preserving, collecting, preparing, reviewing, and producing electronically stored information, which the acronym we're using today is ESI, in the context of the legal process. And as I say, it can be any number of processes, not simply civil discovery. So let me continue with that. Let me see if I can move my screen here. That's my technical problem of the day. One second. Yes, the PowerPoint is not advancing. So I'm going to ask Kayla to come in and work on that. I'm having a glitch in my, she's going to remotely control my screen. Let's let her do that. I think she's done that. Okay, let me continue while we're working on the technical issue. There's no seminar that I've seen, including an electronic discovery, where we do not have some sort of technical issue that troubles us. The other thing I want to emphasize is, although I'm giving you an introduction to electronic discovery, the key point also is that of competence. We're going to talk about ethics at the very end of this program, but I want to also mention to you that in the resources I'm giving you, we have we've assembled a number of ethics opinions. Let me start at the end, because this is a good framework. Anyone who wants to enter the field of electronic discovery has to start from somewhere. And so just as my program is an intro, you want to go to probably something more complex if you're going to handle a matter. So it looks like my screen may be back in touch. Let me just say yes. Okay, thank you, Kayla. So we haven't gone too far, so let me keep going. What I want to also back up and say, the topics I'm going to try to cover are including the world of ESI and how to work with the challenges of doing electronic discovery on the ground. And I'm going to talk a little bit about artificial intelligence. I do want to plug the fact that the Federal Society is holding an all-day program here in Washington, D.C. on October 8th on the new world of artificial intelligence. It does intersect with what I'm doing, so I want to not forget it here, though I'm putting it at the end, so I may not get to it. Okay, so I'm back on track with my PowerPoint. The first big point to make, and this goes to whether attorneys are ready and able to want to handle this, is that our ESI world is very dynamic. We can read in the papers all the time that our information world is expanding exponentially. And I had the caveat in there that we're not limited to civil litigation. I often say to my students in my class that to some extent, this is the challenge going back to the ancient times of trying to navigate a very complicated maze. But I always like to be optimistic and think that we can get into the middle of the maze and slay the minotaur of discovery. Okay. Now, I already foreshadowed this, which is that when you enter the world of electronic discovery, you're encountering a brand new world of terminology and definitions from the computer world. Many, maybe most of us in the practice of law have not been engaged as professionals in the world of computer science. So we need to learn some of the terminology so we're on the same page and indeed speaking the same language as the professionals. So I always indicate that there are sources for this. And again, I'm going to refer back to the Sedona Conference Glossary, which is almost like an encyclopedia, and it tells you every definition ESI related that you need to know. Also, one of the big conceptual problems we have in the ESI world is how to correlate what we know in the old-fashioned paper world with the modern world. Some people say today that almost all of the information in corporate society is native electronic. It has not been generated in the traditional paper format. But we also know that we have a legacy going back, obviously, generations. and practitioners of a certain generation were used to dealing with paper, the famous banker's boxes in warehouses or closets or conference rooms. So we need to have some sort of working sense, sort of a ruler or calibration. The exponential amount of information is startling. We're using terms which I certainly had never heard of before. The basic computer element, the 0-1, is a byte, but we are talking about volumes of information that are now zettabytes. And you can see, even within a four-year period, going back to 2021, the amount of information just in this time period has probably doubled and may double again. The good news, someone asked me this question recently. I said, well, the good news is I found a statistic that about 10% of this new information or the extant information is unique, and a lot of it is repetitive or redundant. And when you think just of an email chain, let's say a company promotes someone and announces it to 500 people, you have 500 copies of that email. So there is redundancy built in. But it's a daunting task for any human, and basically no one is going to try to download everything into some storage database. One of the other challenges of electronic discovery is that much of the data, indeed most of the data, is what we call unstructured. It doesn't fit within some sort of compartmentalization. And that's because we have a lot of decentralized or dispersed generation of ESI in the United States and in the broader world. Okay. So here's my handy dandy ruler. When we think about the old-fashioned box, well, a box is about 3,000 pages. But when you think about a gigabyte, look at that statistic. I mean, we're talking about boxes and pages. And then terabyte, which is a term that people are familiar with as an e-discovery working term for a not atypical discovery sometimes, is 25,000 boxes of documents for a terabyte. So one of the morals of the story here is that we're dealing with volumes of information and the old-fashioned world of manual review, where partners, associates, paralegals, contract attorneys would view eyeball by eyeball every single page of a possibly responsive document is really way by the boards given the volumes of information that we're confronting today. So again, this is sort of how we keep going exponentially, and you can see these are magnitudes of 1,000. So we go from petabytes to exabytes to the world of zettabytes. So that's just basically how we're doing. Just to give you one other example, this is not on a slide, but I found this recently. One source has said, each day on Earth, we generate 500 million tweets, 294 billion emails, 4 million gigabytes of Facebook data, and 65 billion WhatsApp messages. So, and 720,000 hours of new content added daily on YouTube. So you can see that we're really in a sea of information. And just to give you one other visual, if we were stacking up all of this paper, it would be taller than the skyscraper or as low as the trenches in the ocean. So I guess enough said on the volume of information. So the big challenge is, where is it and how do we find it and what do we do with it? One of the other aspects of e-discovery, as I say, it's very dynamic. And I'll use the word traditional. When I started working in the field of e-discovery in the early 2000s, the number of cases generated, decided by courts each year, was probably in the hundreds. And that was the beginning of a tip of a very large iceberg today. I read a statistic that there were 5,000 discovery decisions issued last year. Personally, I find that a high number, but I'm going to take it as true because, as you know, discovery does generate a lot of litigation, and litigation generates a lot of rulings, so the judges adjudicate the disputes among the parties in discovery. So what we call traditional ESI can be email or Word documents. It used to be that text messages on telephones were an innovative and cutting edge for e-discovery, but that's taken for granted now. The world of social media has exploded, so Facebook and Instagram. And again, partially a legacy of the COVID world and our modern business environment, are collaborative tools such as Zoom, the platform we're using today. The other big challenge is not simply getting a handle on what applications or media are generating information that could be relevant to your case or investigation, but where is this? Where is all this data stored or located? Located is a dubious term because many of you in the corporate world are probably familiar with what we call cloud-based computing, where companies agree with a third-party provider that their information will be, quote, stored in the cloud. And it's not a physical location. Yes, there are server farms. So in a way, there is a location somewhere for the data, but it's not always identifiable and could move from location to location. A more down-to-earth, of course, are the applications and uses that we're all familiar with as consumers in our families and in our businesses and in other worlds. And those vary from your phone, smartphone, we'll call it, to a laptop, such as I'm using today, to terminals. One of the big issues we always talk about when we have a corporate setting is basically so many employees are using their phones for dual purposes. Basically, companies have engaged for many years in a bring your own device program rather than the company issue cell phones to however many people. They will rely on their employees to be using the company phones for company business, which implicates a lot of privacy concerns and burden concerns when discovery occurs of an employee's telephone. Okay. One other visual, which I hope will be helpful to you today and in your future practice, is the EDRM model. This was devised years ago by experts in the field called the Electronic Discovery Reference Model. And it's a very good source. I like it because it's fairly simple, at least in cognitive understanding for me. You also will see that it's a continuum, a very important continuum, sort of what I'll call the life cycle of ESI, because you're going to have what we call information governance on the left and presentation of your ESI on the right hand of the chart. It's sort of linear moving forward. I'll come to each of these elements in detail because we're going to talk about them in more detail in a practical application. One of the interesting nuances of this chart is the premise that if we are dealing with vast bodies of information, ESI, that at the left end of our chart, we have a large volume, but because we're analyzing this material, we're separating it out, the relevant from the non-relevant, responsive from non-responsive, that by the time we are ready for trial or the presentation of our information to some outside body, it could be an arbitrator, it could be a internal to the company, the amount of information has been winnowed down from a vast volume so that the relevant information is what is before the tribunal or the decision maker. So there's a downward slope of the volume of information that's actually responsive, and then an upward slope of what is relevant. So these are all very important element stages. And I say it's not just a nice visual. When you have time, you should go to the EDRM model, the website, and look at how they analyze each item. But it's really good for our workflow because when you're starting with an investigation or you're faced with litigation or you're preparing litigation yourself, you want to assemble the information that could be responsive ultimately in your case. And it could be, what are the relevant emails? What are the relevant texts? Whose phones are we going to look at? But you have to know what your information is, and that's why we call it information governance. That's the wheel on the left hand of this chart. It was created later than the EDRM basic model because a lot of people in the field believe very strongly that unless we know our information and where it resides, we won't ever be able to know where it is to produce it in litigation or in an investigation. So it's like a housekeeping that the corporate C-suite is educated as to taking a hard look at what they want to preserve, what the information they want to generate in their business cycles, and how much they want to retain. So it's a housekeeping issue, but it also goes to the fundamental area of business practice, because you're not holding information just for its archival purposes. The federal government's National Archives being an exception to that principle. I'm going to brush over quickly a few other statutes before we get more to the meat of this. I mentioned at the beginning that the Freedom of Information Act is also implicates ESI. The Federal Records Act does so also. Federal agencies have been under a mandate to generate and produce and then retire to the archives their federal records in a digital, meaning non-paper format. Final statute I'll mention is Sarbanes-Oxley. One I didn't put in the slide, and I think if I haven't mentioned it, I will mention it also. The Antitrust Division will basically say to would-be merger candidates in the Hart-Scott-Rodino sphere that if you want to merge, you will have to produce information in electronic format for us. I didn't have a slide on that, but it shows you that this transcends litigation. I always ask people, why am I even including FOIA in this? Well, Freedom of Information Act often is an adjunct to litigation. Requesters are often looking for what the government is doing. And so the federal government does have an obligation to produce information, and increasingly, again, in electronic format. I'm not going to spend much time on this. I just want everyone to know it. Many of us practice in Washington, D.C., and that's a fertile area for FOIA litigation. So we see that there's going to be more and more digital information. And again, there's a broad statement in FOIA that agencies have to make their information available in a format that's accessible to the requester. And basically, there is a standard for FOIA that's somewhat similar to that of civil discovery, which is to make reasonable efforts to produce information. I'm not discussing many cases in my PowerPoint today in the interest of time. So I'm going to basically rely on all of you who want to do this when the slides become available to read these cases if they're of interest to you. And I'm not going to try to read these PowerPoint slides. These are just two interesting cases that I have found that deal with Freedom of Information Act and do relate often to civil litigation as well. So just the way of how courts are trying to analogize the FOIA world, the modern FOIA world, to the old-fashioned search world. So I'm going to skip over this in the interest of time. We have very few cases in e-discovery from the appellate courts. Same is true to some extent of Freedom of Information Act, in part because the district courts are really those who deal with discovery disputes, and they really, or FOIA disputes, and they don't always reach an appellate body. So that's just a footnote point. A Federal Records Act, again, as I say, we're looking at a very broad definition of what is a federal record as we go forward in time. Sarbanes-Oxley, here's a special duty by the regulators for the accountant world. So we have to think of preservation in that context as well. Okay. So I'm going to turn to some practical issues here. And again, my client could be anyone. It could be the government. It could be a corporation. It could be a small business. It could be, I will even venture to say, a spouse in a divorce proceeding. We always have to ask a lot of reporter-type questions. Who, what, where, and why. And we have to think about the priorities going forward. I somehow have already assumed for us today that we have some idea of our world, our ESI world, if we've had good information governance especially. But basically, if we have litigation, we're going to have a number of priorities along that continuum of identification and preservation. So basically, for preservation, we have to begin when there's a reasonable anticipation of litigation to preserve possibly relevant information. And this is going to be a challenge for the client and the attorney. The client may or may not be sophisticated in terms of business and litigation. The attorney hopefully is, again, coming back to my competence point. So it's really a who, what, where inquiry. What is the volume of the litigation? I've talked about the location issue. We always have to fix in any litigation, what is the timeline? Are we going to be producing data going 10 years back or 2 years back? Will we look at the statute of limitations, for example? That may be a short one. A lot of complexities there. The key people involved in a transaction may well be your most valuable sources of electronically stored information. Maybe not the people who are tangentially related to a transaction or a business deal that went sour. Who are the key players, the decision makers? But we don't want to forget the people who are holding this information in some virtual way, the old-fashioned records manager or other custodians. And as we know in litigation, some relevant information may be in the hands of non-parties who can be reached only in the civil context by a Rule 45 subpoena. So the key questions always for us is, when does this obligation to preserve information arise? Reasonable anticipation of litigation is a phrase, but it's in some people's views very subjective. And it's going to be a judge several years later, perhaps, identifying when you as a corporation reasonably knew that you were going to be sued. So what is the trigger date? I always refer people to now a very old case called Zubelake, where these issues were adjudicated some time back. And it's an old case, but it still has lessons on the trigger issue. Now, in our modern computer world, you have the other challenge, which is computers do act on their own. And some computers by program have auto-delete functions. Email systems themselves can even be programmed to delete emails after 30, 60, 90 days. Some email systems, if there are no capacity or storage issues, the email will be there for a very long time. On the other hand, you may have systems that you retire and replace with new systems. Will you migrate your old data to a new platform? We saw that with some of the old email platforms like Lotus and various things back in the earlier time periods. So basically, it really requires a lot of investigation by the client working with the counsel. And you really are going to intervene, actively intervene, to place a litigation hold, which I put capital L, capital H, in place with instructions to employees not to auto-delete, not to delete their files that may be relevant simply because, well, I'm running out of email storage or this doesn't look important. So basically, it's very important for the counsel to work with the client and not simply let the client do it on their own. That sometimes is a path of destruction. So the attorney's dilemma is, how wide am I casting my fishing net? If you cast it too narrowly, you're going to miss a lot of information. If you cast it too broadly, you're going to be overburdening your client, and you're going to be finding a lot of information that, frankly, isn't relevant to the case before you. The other key players, not simply the people in the transaction, but your information technology staff, they may be instrumental in knowing how you can preserve information, store it, so it's not subject to deterioration or tampering. Could be a cybersecurity issue there. And then the other two practice pointers are basically that you want to, as counsel, monitor what is going on. You cannot put these preservation and collection processes on some sort of autopilot for your counsel. They're going to want your direction, and you would be remiss if you don't give them direction. And I always say to people that you really need to document what you're doing as you proceed, because again, a judge a year later may say, well, I don't see that you preserved information from the human resources department or from this particular regional office. Where is that documented? So you really need to maintain a log of what you've done And also, if the case is modified, you need to also make some modifications as your case proceeds. So again, the counsel's role is paramount, and I need to do my own assessment. I need to do case strategy. What is the scope of this case? There may be situations where the case should be dismissed on jurisdictional grounds. Your dilemma still may be to preserve the information while that motion is pending, but you need to obviously supervise the client. The good news, I guess, in the e-discovery world is that over time, the experts have developed pretty good technology. Technology-assisted review, so that the attorney and client, with usually an outside vendor, an expert company, can do the efforts of identifying and collecting information that is preserved, and then determine what you're going to do with it as the case proceeds. Basically, the issue will be, if you think it is responsive, then you will be turning it over to the other side, the plaintiff or defendant. And if the case is symmetrical in discovery, you will be getting electronic discovery from your opposing party as well. Now, I'm not going to go into the nuts and bolts of how I produce the information. Suffice it to say that in the old-fashioned paper world, if you sent someone a banker's box of documents, they were all there, and hopefully they were in the right order. But in today's electronic world, because things are not necessarily stored or created in the same format, the parties have to really sit down and talk about how they are going to exchange this ESI. It's a matter of making sure that if I send you information in a certain format, you'll be able to read it. So it may be you'll have to have compatible software. Also, you may want to produce or be required to produce information in what we call its native format. Native format means exactly how it was initially produced, not modified. You probably know if you go to the Word program, you will see so many fields that tell you everything you wanted to know about the creation and modification of that document. So that's very important to know. Metadata is called the information about the information. It could be a data field modified by, read by, blind CC'd by. So in many cases, and this is just my personal view, in many cases, is metadata going to be at all relevant to anything in this lawsuit? That's a threshold question to ask. If the parties agree that metadata is not relevant, then that additional hurdle is really not one you need to leap. Now, again, in my time, I want to emphasize a few other client-related points, and this raises ethical concerns as well. We all know that in litigation, whether it's federal or state, criminal or civil, we have a range of privileges. The most prominent for most attorneys will be attorney-client privilege and attorney work product. Now, those of you who practice in various federal sectors will know that there's also deliberative process privilege. There could be law enforcement privilege. And there are also common law privileges, marital privileges, doctor-patient privileges to go on. But basically, any company, any entity, and indeed individuals are going to have privacy and privilege issues. The federal court system has done a limited amount of protection in this area. And again, I'm going to refer you to two important rules to look up and consult on your own time. The federal civil rule 26B was intended to set up a procedure so that if counsel are aware of the exchange or inadvertent disclosure of, let us say, an attorney-client document, inadvertent disclosure in a massive ESI, that there would be a procedure to identify it and litigate whether the privilege was waived. I won't get into the law of waiver here. As a better approach, the Congress enacted the Federal Rules of Evidence 502, which sets up basically an anti-waiver protection if the parties agree that they will excuse, if I can use the word, the inadvertent disclosure of privileged information. That's not a waiver by having done that. And the parties can agree that notwithstanding that event has occurred, from the standpoint of the litigation or even state litigation, that information remains privileged in terms of its status. Now, it may be not privileged for other reasons, could be wrongly invoked, but the disclosure of it to the other party will not operate as a waiver. So when you're working with a client, first and foremost, you want to figure out how are you going to navigate that. This protection is not going to extend to other privileges. And clients may be very sensitive about information, especially proprietary information, that would not be covered by the four corners of these rules as well. At later in this program, time permitting, I'm going to mention an ethics ruling by the state of California bar where an attorney got into very hot water because of the problem of inadvertent waiver of privilege. Another seminar could be devoted to the whole issue of the admissibility of ESI at court or summary judgment. Just to back up a little bit, when you are preserving your information and then when you are identifying it as relevant, you want to already be thinking about your chain of custody and the authenticity of your information because it may be featured in your summary judgment motion later. Or if you find out that that information is in your opponent's summary judgment motion, you want to be able to verify that indeed it was one of your information sources, and then therefore you at least will know its authenticity. So it's never too early to start thinking about these issues as opposed to waiting for your pretrial order. In the course of discovery is a good opportunity to sift through and make sure that you have ESI that is authentic and will not be challenged as otherwise. I'm going to take a little bit of time because this is very important to federal court practitioners in particular on the rule changes of 2015. This was a very ambitious and indeed controversial in some quarters, modifications to the discovery rules, which really had not been significantly altered in a long period of time. They had very fundamental goals in mind. The Chief Justice's report basically was reflecting the view of many that civil litigation was becoming too expensive, too cumbersome, and too time-consuming, and therefore, it was a time to really reform the process, sort of a three-pillar approach, cooperation among the parties, proportionality in discovery, and active judicial case management. I'm going to focus on proportionality because that involves the parties predominantly. Active judicial case management was shorthand for the courts, meaning the judges becoming active earlier in the case and not taking a passive approach. The theory is that if a court intervenes early enough in an incipient to-be discovery dispute, it'll be cheaper and the courts will remain on track rather than have discovery disputes pile up and then it becomes very difficult to untangle them. So the Chief Justice in his year-end report talked about really very fundamental principles of reasonable limits on discovery, and he described it as the common sense concept of proportionality. Like everything else that's a non-objective term, non-quantitative term, it's going to be for everybody to have to figure that out in any specific case. But the lesson that he wanted to impart was that attorneys should really spend more time and not simply do what I will call issue blunderbuss requests for production, casting that wide, very widely and hoping that something comes back, but really burdening your opposing party in the meantime. So it's a sense that cases can be overdone from the standpoint of the discovery, and tailoring the discovery to what is needed in the case is one of the underlying messages of these reforms. So I'm not going to walk you through these rules in great detail. You really want to look at them yourselves and consult the committee notes, which are very helpful to explain the rationale. But basically, what they are trying to do is set some parameters or limits. So what we're looking at is information that first is relevant. If it's not relevant, then obviously it's not produced But also it has to be proportional to the needs of the case. So we're looking at things that are to the core of the transaction and not peripheral or sort of transitory to it. And the good news or bad news, depending on how you look at rules, is that at least there are several factors for us to look at. So if you and your opposing counsel are sitting down to hash out agreed discovery, this is sort of a checklist for you to analyze first with your client and then with the opposing counsel. And obviously, while I'm not going to put any factor ahead of any other, certainly if we have an amount of controversy of $200,000, we're not going to spend $100,000 of discovery on it. At least the common sense would tell us that that's not a wise investment for the output. So you're going to have a lot of factors to look at. And again, I refer you to the notes. It's a balancing act, and we have to decide what is the benefit of this discovery versus its burden. To some extent, it can be quantified, sometimes not. If you have a civil rights case, a public sector case, where there's not a money damages or necessarily back pay or front pay, these are going to be more of a challenge to evaluate the breadth of the discovery. Again, why we can step back and ask why this was done when it was done. It was done really as a reaction, a cumulative understanding, if you will, that the beginning in the 1980s, 1990s, and into the year 2000s, that decade, you see this exponential increase in information, the world going digital, and that discovery was used by some in terms of not simply seeking the fact-finding truth of the information, but discovery can be used in certain instances as a tactic of delay, or actually use the word oppression, because you can basically burden another party with very extensive discovery. And at the time, there wasn't this parameter or limitation of what we call today proportionality. So that's very important to see. So one of my lessons to everyone is that you have to sit down first with your client, and then you need to have what are called under our Rule 26, Rule 26F meet and confer sessions. The judge is going to expect you to discuss these issues before you sit down and draft a proposed pretrial order. So it's front loading again this discovery process. It's a broad range of menu for you to discuss these issues. And again, you cannot procrastinate on these. Again, the committee note is recognizing that there are various vehicles by which you can have less burdensome review. TAR, which I've mentioned, is one of those methodologies. It says, if time permitted, I will discuss it at the end. I already know that time will not permit me to do that, but I have some slides that are good resources on that for you. So hopefully you can look at those on your own. Any decision on e-discovery scope has to look at how much do we have information? What's our litigation budget? Do we want to go into an outside source, a vendor source, to do something that's reviewed by other computers as opposed to manual review? Okay. My word to the wise are also to be proactive. If you are passive in your approach to discovery, your opposing counsel may not be, and the judge is going to be possibly much more impressed by a litigant who has a plan and says, this is my reasonable plan, and the other side has refused to negotiate with me or really hasn't met me even part way. So a lot of this does depend on trying to learn your case and advocate for it, including the discovery you need or the discovery that you say is not proportional. There is a little theme to the 2015 amendments, and we see that in some of the cases. The notion that judges do want to be case managers, active case managers, and try to achieve proportional discovery. I did not mention, and I will now, that I tried to do a survey on how many states have adopted the federal rules. There's no good source that I've seen. I just found a study the other day that suggested that 14 states have adopted the 2015 amendments in some form or the other. Four or so have explicitly rejected them. And then about 30 states have not taken action. Now, these rules went into effect on the federal level 2015. So really, you have to look at your own state if you're in state court to see whether your court has followed, meaning incorporated by adoption, usually through the state Supreme Court, the federal civil rules, or whether you're dealing with a regime, if I can use that word, that's not emphasizing proportionality. Final take-home point, I guess, is that the court also, the federal system now has an amended Rule 1, which is to say that the rules are to be employed by the parties to secure the just, speedy, and inexpensive resolution of proceedings, making it much more of a shared effort. So again, there's a notion that the parties should be assisting this process along and not obstructing it. Okay. In a few minutes I have, I'm going to say, what can go wrong? Well, many things can go wrong. And there's no particular checklist in terms of which is worse on my bullet points here. The failure to cooperate is going to generate discovery disputes and perhaps judges who are not going to be very happy to see the opposing counsel in court if they can't resolve. The failure to communicate, no surprise. You have to be on the same page as to what you've agreed to. And if you have different views as to what you just agreed to do, it's probably no better than no agreement at all. So you have to be clear. The courts are also very impatient with discovery requests and objections that are unilluminating, that are boilerplate. And the rule actually has been amended to make that very clearly sanctionable. So if you issue, I hate to use the word fishing expedition, but if you send requests in that are purely fishing expeditions, or if you respond with a non-response, that's going to be very, very troubling to a judge. Final 2 points I'll mention as I'm running closer to time is we do have many failures at the very beginning of parties to implement litigation holds or doing it inconsistently. Or yes, there are still many rulings we see in the court where parties have actually negligently or recklessly or yes, intentionally deleted responsive information, which leads to sanctions. You do have a duty, by the way, under Rule 26G to certify the reasonableness of your discovery request. So just Rule 37 quickly, because I'm going to be running up for questions in a minute. You just want to be aware of these rules, which call for either measures or sanctions, depending on the severity of what's been done. These rules apply, by the way, not to paper, but to electronically stored information. So you have to go through this checklist to see if the information is lost, should have been preserved, failure to take those steps. You cannot get this information in some alternative. And the courts have certain measures at their command, which can include letting the jury hear about the dispute, forbidding you from providing some of the evidence that supported your claim. And then the ultimate sanction, which can be dismissal, is if you find specific intent to destroy that information, you can reach very draconian penalties, including instructions to the jury and the outright dismissal of your action. So in a couple minutes, I'm just going to mention the ethics issues. The ABA modified Rule 1.1 to the comment 8 to say that attorneys need to be current on technology. And there is a state bar ethics opinion, a hypothetical where an attorney basically sort of went forth without any direction in e-discovery. And the long and short of it was he inadvertently shared his client's proprietary information with the opposing party, who was a competitor. So again, one of the worst case scenarios, but lessons to be learned if you're going to enter the world of e-discovery. Final word is that artificial intelligence does intersect with electronic discovery, and there are a lot of ethics opinions on that. TAR is not the same as the open-ended artificial intelligence. I'll just leave it at that. And people who wish to contact me after the program with questions, I'm sure Kayla will give my contact information. And I'm going to, these slides are talks about a protocol in a case called the broiler chicken litigation. So I'm not sure if this slide is going to be useful or make anyone hungry, but that just talks about some more on an interesting issue that we call technology assisted review. Some useful cases to look at. Mata is a case where an attorney did use false citations, citations that didn't exist, and he was sanctioned for it under Rule 11. And many Sedona resources for you. State Bar opinion I mentioned, some very good resources on artificial intelligence. So with that, I'm going to end. It's about 10 minutes of, and I'm going to check and see, maybe Kayla, do you have some questions that you can hand over to me, and I'll try to answer those.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that. That was a really substantive and useful overview of a complex and interesting issue. We do have audience questions, and I'll issue the brief reminder. If there are audience members who have questions and you want to submit those, please do that by the Q&A feature, and we'll do our best to get to as many as we can. Starting with a question from our audience, how is ESI Bates stamped?
Well, that's a good point. As many of you who have litigated in former years know that there was a machine called a Bates stamper that mechanically moved and created numbers sequentially on document pages. There are ways to do an electronic Bates stamp that's very similar when you program through an e-discovery vendor. There's also a very esoteric unique identifier called a hash value, which can be embedded in ESI so that you know that it's unique. In other words, if someone changed a character on that page from an S to a T, that image will have a different hash value. So there is a way to do it, you are relying on technology to do it as opposed to sitting in your conference room with this old-fashioned Bates stamp.
Got it. Thanks so much. Next audience question asks about if you could talk about ESI in corporate transaction due diligence.
Well, I will say in response to that, I'm not a corporate attorney, but I do know from reading the literature that in-house attorneys, a general counsel's office or retained counsel may be reviewing transactions for various criteria. Maybe they're facing an investigation from a Federal Trade Commission or another regulatory agency. So it's not something I've done, but I know it is done. And you are probably going to make a decision. What's the volume of information? The good news is you're doing it in-house in a sense, so you don't have various privilege or other issues. Do you want to get a vendor for it? Maybe you can. Some companies have in-house e-discovery capabilities. So it is something that can be done. And, the only word I will say, which I didn't get to do in terms of my presentation, is that there is an art, or maybe some would say a science, to using the correct search terms. And that's why people promote the sophistication of technology-assisted review, which uses algorithms, over manual review, where you and I would sit down and think, well, the best search term for this case is widget. Well, if someone doesn't spell the word widget correctly, we miss the wadgets. So that's a very blunt example. So yes, in the corporate, it's a good e-discovery, which I'm using in a very generic sense, certainly could be used in an internal setting.
Got it. Thanks so much. Next audience member asks, and you were touching on this at the end as we moved into questions, so they're teeing up the opportunity. Could you talk about TAR briefly?
Well, TAR is a very modern, I'll use that word, method. It's called technology assisted review. And the sources, I think I provided several sources. What people discovered was that manual review, where you do search terms, was very primitive and missed a lot. People could not agree sometimes on search terms. So in TAR, to use that word, you often will start with some sort of automated process to get something like a seed set of potentially responsive documents. You might say, well, we know this transaction is about widgets during 1989, and the widgets failed because of this factor. So you might sit down and create a seed set of responsive documents. You might use documents that you know are responsive because they're the key documents. And then you try to train this algorithm system to recognize similar documents, clustering or families. And you also may use, and this gets into variations, you may use people who are subject matter experts in this area, and they will help devise it. So it's not a random sample of information out of your larger pool. The nice thing that people say about TAR is it also is what they call continuous active learning, which is it's not a static process. You can, as you move through it, you can analyze the results and see if you're on the right track. Are you getting responsive information? Are you missing responsive information? It's a science in and of itself, but it certainly is used in larger cases. It's well accepted in the courts. If it's done appropriately, no surprise, the courts also are emphasizing disclosure and the other word you often hear, transparency. So if I'm going to be the plaintiff and launching TAR for all of my production and the defendant gets the end product, he or she says, well, I don't know where this came from. What rules did you use? And the judges do expect disclosure about how I'm going through that process.
Got it. Very useful. Next audience question asks if you could talk about ESI and corporate transactions that are outside of government investigations.
Well, again, my caveat is that's really not my field. I do know from some people I've spoken to that you may have a company that is doing an internal investigation for efficiency's sake, or maybe we don't understand why. Something is going on in one region and not as successful in another region, or why are personnel in some region performing this way versus that way? I mean, some of this does implicate privacy issues, of course, if we get into the people in a company. But a company may have reasons to look internally at its systems and use ESI tools, even if it's not a preventive or proactive measure, thinking that that the government will be looking at it for wrongdoing. Certainly, the Hart-Scott-Rodino example is where the companies do want to merge, but a condition of their merger is to send ESI to the antitrust division for it to review. So I don't know where that falls.
Got it. Thanks. It's very helpful. Well, last audience question, and you've touched on this some, so it could be that you're just going to restate a couple of what you've, couple points you've already raised. But an audience member asks if you could give sort of some lay level terms for examples of what's covered by electronic discovery. I'm from like a 1,000-foot view.
Well, I think I'd start sort of with probably I used the word traditional before. The first litigation was over email. And it was succeeded by usually people interested in Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, text messaging on your phone used to be not as frequently requested, in part because the technology to retrieve that information wasn't as easy. So basically, the other thing I'll say is, and people will have to think about this, is there's also a world called the Internet of Things. And the best example of that are self-driving vehicles. There's a computer in those vehicles that is telling the vehicles what to do. Some people have smart refrigerators. Some people wear Fitbits. And there's some cases involving what was the information on the Fitbit that could be relevant to a case. So alarm systems, many cases involving video. Some would say, well, video doesn't sound like it's electronically stored information, but the courts over the years said, well, video is no longer real to real or analog. It's digitized. It may, you know, may exist sometimes in that form. So there are many, many cases all the time over videos, people who slip in stores, alarm systems, security systems. So video is included in the ESI world as well.
Got it. Well, that rounds us out with our audience question, also brings us to the top of the hour, so we can wrap it there. Professor Hurt, thanks so much. Really appreciate you sharing your expertise and insight today. It was a fascinating discussion. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.